This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning. Just now doing prostrations, the question came to my mind, where in the world are we? Of course, we all have some idea. We're at Isanji Temple, Hartford Street Zen Center. We're in San Francisco. We take it for granted that if we would answer that question more or less the same way, we're referring to a stable and shared reality. You can sit closer if you want. It's up to you. Okay. But it's actually not so. The detailed conventional agreement we have about our world is, well, it's fairly effective, but it's full of holes. And not only that, it's kind of our it can be our prison. In contrast with conventional reality, there's what we might call reality, period. Reality not based on agreement. Typically unspoken and unexamined agreement. See the world, as it actually is. We realize that the reality that's agreed upon is actually very small. And true reality, although I'm already getting into trouble with the language here. True reality is, well, nobody knows how vast. Maybe even the Buddhas don't know how vast. So, based on our teaching, I think Buddhists, maybe not just Buddhists, would like to be familiar with this true reality. In other words, everyone would like to be enlightened. I imagine that even people who might say they don't want to be enlightened, they actually want to be enlightened. So, where is, how do we get at reality per se? And if we had access to reality per se, what would happen? Would Isanji Temple disappear? And everyone in it also? Expressed that way, though, it does sound as though there's a kind of a, maybe there's a gap or an abyss that we have to cross in order to encounter actual reality. Well, in a sense, there is. But the abyss, from that point of view, is actually so enormous that, as an old song says, you can't get over it. The Buddha way is, as you know, is sometimes expressed as a path. And with that metaphor, of course, path needs to be traversed. You need to travel the path. And then presumably at the end of the path, there's something nice waiting for you. When some of our ancestors tell stories about the path, it's kind of incredible how long it is. Something like, 3 incalculable eons. And I guess that's one of the traditional definitions. And then, of course, if we wonder, well, how long is that? We've just said it's incalculable, so forget it. We can't even say how long it is. For some reason, past couple of days, another old song has been running through my mind. Mr. Tambourine Man. Anybody remember that? When I think of that song, I think of Dylan Roche. Not so much the Birds version. That's okay too, but the voice I hear in my mind is Bob. And I think, you know, everyone, what does he say? Everyone wants to dance beneath a diamond sky. I was reading that my theory is that Bob Dylan was on acid when he wrote that song, and I think that's a common idea. Someone has asserted that no, he didn't actually take acid until some months after he wrote that song. Personally, I'm inclined to think that that's not right, because that song is as convincing a verbal picture of an acid trip as anything else you might want. So again, I think one of the usual understandings is that at the end of this incalculably long path, we will be dancing beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free. So maybe that's true, but in the meantime, we might want to consider, where in the world are we, actually? And to really enter that question without asking anybody else about it. See, if you do that, then you'll just wind up with another convention, another agreement. So if we devote ourselves to that question, the world, what we call the world, reveals itself differently. And every step we take in that world is a little bit of a mystery. Right now, various places around the world, people are suffering badly because of various kinds of weather. And quite possibly, if you know, if one of those hurricanes landed on us, and we would ask some people actually. They might think, and they might say, well, I don't know, but I'd really rather be anywhere but here. Anywhere where, you know, the wind isn't pulling the roof off my house. So, you know, things can get a little tense for us humans, depending on our circumstances. And when things are really tense and difficult, we can, just out of habit, we can fall back very, very heavily onto the conventional shared view. Then the what is it? The windy beach. Far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. It seems very far away. So in what we sometimes call our way, the Buddha way, or sometimes people say Zen or Chan, we like to encourage ourselves and one another to kind of walk in the way of mystery. Walk in such a fashion that the borders of conventional world become translucent. And the great and mysterious source is a reality for us. Again, a typical understanding is that we come together and we practice Zazen or meditation or something. And so that something will be, you know, revealed to us. And then, when that happens, we can very happily follow Mr. Tambourine Man wherever he goes. This isn't quite right, actually. Another way to put it is, we don't have our practice in order to understand the mystery, but we practice because of the mystery, because we are mystery. And no matter how conventionally we are thinking or living, the mystery is unaffected. So a lot of our Zen stories, you know, many of them, you know, they kind of sound like, sort of sound like the Mr. Tambourine Man song. They seem to be talking about something that's just a little outside of our experience. But if that were true, that really wouldn't be very helpful. So I like to remind people that those stories are talking about our actual experience. Now, not something that's going to happen at the end of some long path. And our ancestors knew this. And, you know, if you study our campfire tales, you see this over and over again. This, if you like, lesson being passed down to us. For instance, our great ancestor, our founding ancestor, Dongshan Liangzhi, was out for a walk with his spiritual uncle, who was a Dharma brother of Dongshan's teacher, Yunyan. And he was, this fellow was just known as Spiritual Uncle Mi. So Spiritual Uncle Mi and Dongshan are out for a walk, and a rabbit dashes across the path. And Dongshan says, "That was fast." And Spiritual Uncle Mi says, "Yeah, quicker than a commoner becomes a minister." And Dongshan stops and looks askance at him and says, "Venerable sir, you still say stuff like this?" And Uncle Mi is a little bit taken aback and says, "Well, what do you say, Acharya?" Acharya meaning teacher. And Dongshan says, what does he say? "Generations of nobility temporarily fallen into hard times." Now, that story perfectly encapsulates what I'm talking about. And those two characters, whether or not they actually existed, I don't know. Maybe they did. Somebody did, obviously, or we wouldn't be here. They were okay with cultivating, walking in mystery. The one way of looking at that story, of course, is in China, a commoner could become a minister. But this is a very long, long path, requiring endless study and difficult examinations. But it's also true that, well, if you ask, When is the moment that the commoner becomes the minister? And you realize it's when the emperor says so. Now! It's not the, after all of your exams and you've read all of the Confucian doctrine, it's when the emperor says, now. So, from that perspective, this eons long path is revealed to be another convention. Another agreement in which we have temporarily fallen on hard times. But our actual lineage is noble. And our many illustrious ancestors walked in mystery and are still walking in mystery. And they invite us to join them. So, if I might suggest anyway that Mr. Tambourine Man is always shaking his tambourine, you don't have to go find him someplace. Or swallow some acid and go out to Ocean Beach, although, you can do that if you want, which is not really necessary. And you can go out to Ocean Beach right now if you want, and all you can celebrate how all memory and fate is driven deep beneath the waves already. And then you too will be content to walk in mystery without actually not quite knowing where in the world we are. That's what I recommend. But of course, you all must do as you please. You have some question?
Where are you?
You got vision problems there?
Yes.
Oh, I'm very sorry, feeling. I'm with you. Yes.
Recently, when I was at the Grand Canyon, I was sitting next to a fellow. We were watching the light change as the sun went down and commenting back and forth to one another how the brown became purple and the gray became green and so on. I thought, this is really quite marvelous that two people can sit here and have this shared experience of something that's very subtle, mm-hmm. and actually be able to use language to communicate to one another and have a seemingly shared experience.
Seemingly, yes.
And, you know, I couldn't, in the middle of it, I couldn't help but think about Uchiyama Roshi's comment of, like, when two people regard a teacup, they think they're regarding the same teacup,
right.
but they're not.
Right.
What, there's the teacup of your reality and the teacup of the other person's reality. Mm-hmm. But still, because there's enough shared
right.
between us because of the way human organisms are built
yeah.
and the way light reflects on objects and enters the eye and
right.
so on and so forth, endless, right?
Right.
We have this feeling
that
we can share
yeah.
experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize that I'm always having a subtle sense of frustration that I can't share enough with other people.
Mm.
Basically, it's, oh, nobody's interested in what I'm interested in, nobody thinks like I think, blah, 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 you know, goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But those are, I think, as you say, those thoughts or feelings are really based upon some sort of distinction one makes between self and other that are not necessarily correct or on the beam.
Or not complete, maybe,
yeah.
I'd say. Yeah. Of course, what you say is true. While you were speaking, I had a vision of my teacup that I was using this morning, and there are places where we could go in the world, I think still, and we could put that teacup down, and some other people that we meet would not know what that was. They could not recognize it. Maybe they couldn't even see it. There is no such thing in their world. And so they don't even know what that is. So to me, this points to the fact that reality is inexhaustible and ever-changing, and that our convention is built on that sort of conversation you're talking about, but it stops short of what reality is actually like. And occasionally things will happen which will remind us of that. So it's true, I can look at the red incense box over there, and I can ask someone else, well, what's that color? And they may say, oh, it's red. And yet there is no way I can know what their red is. It's simply not possible. We have some agreement that something that looks like that we'll say is red. But what it actually looks like to that other person, I will never know. So no matter how carefully we try to nail down our reality, some of it is always escaping. Sort of like, I used to have hair, and I used to have kind of long hair, and sometimes, and no matter how carefully I tried to gather it up, some of it would always come loose and come around and hit me in the face. And reality is like that. No matter how carefully we try to tie it up, something comes loose. And this doorway into mystery is a doorway to liberation. So I don't, you didn't exactly have a question, so I'm just kind of responding to what you said. Reality is an agreement, and that agreement does not exhaust reality. Something like that. Yes.
I was drawing a parallel to the talk we had last week on what is truth and what is reality.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, you know, this is the ultimate dilemma. You know?
Yeah. It's also good news, though, that we are not, as Dogen says, it's never apart from us, wherever we are. That's the good news. And without a grasping mind, to constantly cultivate that, frees up our heart. It actually does. Well,
you say it's can be a fine line between appreciating something and grasping after the appreciation.
Sure, I mean, that's always tempting. But the other good news is, as soon as we start grasping, suffering arises, and that will remind us we're better off not doing that. Or another way to put it, we're better off practicing non-attachment. It'd be nice if we could just say, okay, I'm not going to grasp anything evermore again, starting now. But I haven't actually seen anybody succeed with that. It's more like, okay, I'm going to rededicate myself to the practice of non-attachment, which means knowing intimately what attachment feels like and being able to let it go. And once we hear the teaching about attaching to things, about attachment, it's pretty easy to recognize it. Did you have a question?
I was just thinking that we tend to use the phrase seeing reality as it is, or seeing things that they are, and I was thinking that, you know, that kind of leaves me with this sort of frustrated, constipated feeling, and that flipping it a little bit and saying seeing reality as it isn't, or seeing things as they aren't, can be a useful thing. But I could also see that may be just a personal tool, personal way of looking at it, and you can get into trouble by presenting it that way. So I'm wondering what you think about saying those two sides of things.
Well, seeing things as they are is not what it seems. You probably know this story of back when logical positivism was the exciting philosophy of the day, and I can't even remember who the protagonists are in this dialogue, but anyway, maybe it was Bertrand Russell or somebody's out on a walk, like Dongshan and Uncle Mi, and I guess they're talking about the philosophy of Bishop Berkeley, who was maybe postulated that, you know, maybe when we're not thinking about something, it vanishes. You know, we assume that it's there, but maybe it's not. And Russell or somebody stopped and stamped on the ground and said, "Thus, I refute Bishop Berkeley." And if I were there, I would have said, "Well, so you actually know what stamping on the ground is? You've actually examined that all the way through?" And of course, he hadn't. If he had, things might have looked rather grim for the logical positivists, because you realize wait a minute, there's something there that I can't grasp. And that's not logical positivism. Right? If there is any such thing, we ignore it because we're positive. Seeing things as they are is also inexhaustible. So if it has a sticky or difficult feeling for you, just, you know, keep at it. And don't decide that, okay, now I'm seeing things as they are, and it's boring. It's like, okay, go.
Yeah, I think it's similar to that, because I was also thinking about the concept of the path and how do they give a nod to the fact that you can't. That implies that there's something that's not the path, but actually there isn't anything that's not the path.
Uh-huh.
No, I just forgot where I was.
That's probably far enough. And so maybe that'll do. Thank you all very much.